WFAE wants to know which question we should answer next on FAQ City. How did Charlotte become a banking city? What's the story behind the water towers around town? And when did the crown become the symbol for Charlotte? Find the FAQ City podcast and cast your vote for your favorite question on WFAE.org/FAQ City. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. If being bullied as a child can lead to adverse consequences later in life, imagine the impact on a child of neglect and abuse by their parents. Yet both occur every day. 700,000 cases of child abuse and neglect are reported each year, and the Centers for Disease Control estimates the lifetime cost of treating those children is $200,000 apiece. When you add all of this together, all of the children who are neglected or abused, that number comes, are you sitting down, to $124 billion. As the number of abused and neglected children continues to rise, up 38% in the last decade, getting a handle on this problem becomes paramount not just to defray the monetary costs, but the human costs. In Charlotte, there are a number of agencies involved in helping children and ending this cycle, and fortunately, several are joining forces. We've asked a few of the leaders of those organizations to spend the hour with us to talk about what they're doing. Jacqueline McKnight is Deputy Director for Child and Family Services at the Mecklenburg County Department of Social Services. Thank you for being here this morning.
Thank you.
Janet Harmon is Director of Outreach and Education at Pat's Place Child Advocacy Center. We'll find out all about that this morning. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
Sharon Hirsch is President and CEO of Prevent Child Abuse North Carolina. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Bob Simmons is Executive Director of the Council for Children's Rights and Chair of the Mecklenburg Child Fatality Prevention and Protection Team. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mike.
You can join us if you'd like our conversation by emailing us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. You can search for WFAE on Facebook, get to us through Twitter @CharlotteTalks, and you can join us this morning on Facebook Live. You didn't know you were going to be on television, but you all look good. Your makeup's perfect. I just gave out some national figures, Jacqueline, on child abuse and neglect and how those numbers have grown over the last 10 years. Are those numbers similar to numbers? Are they comparable to numbers in Mecklenburg County?
Yes, the number of reports that Mecklenburg investigates is approximately 10,400 annually, and that's annually, and that has remained consistent.
Oh, so it's not growing like the national numbers are over the last decade.
We've seen upticks; it goes up,
okay,
and it goes down, but generally that's kind of where we've been for the last 2 years.
Now, prior to accepting your current position here in Mecklenburg County, you were in New York City, where you were New York City's Administration for Children's Services, the Deputy Commissioner there.
That's correct.
How do our numbers? How does the situation in Mecklenburg County compare to what New York City faces?
Yeah,
the numbers are bigger in New York, but what about the problems themselves?
Well, the issues are consistent. Child abuse and neglect in Charlotte is the same child abuse issues that are raised in New York City. Of course, the volume is significantly different. In New York City, you handle about 60,000 investigations annually.
Wow. Bob, the Council for Children's Rights says that child maltreatment is one of the most significant issues impacting child welfare in this county, Mecklenburg County. I know you're only over Mecklenburg, but we have listeners all over the place and all these other counties. Are we similar to those counties? Are they similar to us? Do you know?
Well, because of the larger population in Mecklenburg County and the difference between the structure of our community and those in the counties that surround us, because we're more urban, things are a bit different in Mecklenburg County than they are in our immediately surrounding counties. But one of the things that we've seen, and we're just about to release our child maltreatment report today, is in 2016-2017, we actually had a decrease in the number of reports here in Mecklenburg County.
Well, that's good news.
Yes, it is good news. It's down by about 568 children between 2015-16 and 2016-17.
In 2015-16, you had well over 14,000 children, evidently.
Yes.
Or 5.55, I think, percent of all children under the age of 18 were mistreated. So that number is declining this year?
Yes. Last year? The information is 13,968 mm-hmm. children in 2016-17, which is 4.6%. And one of the things that we're seeing is that contrary to the rest of the state, where there has been a recent spike in the increase in the number of children who are going into foster care, mm-hmm. that we continue to see a decline in Mecklenburg County in the number of children who are going into foster
care. What about the numbers that you first reported? Is that the numbers that are declining as well? Are they just reports of child abuse and neglect, or is that actual cases of childhood abuse and neglect? How many fall through the cracks? Do we know?
That's actually the number of reports.
Okay.
The number of investigations and the number of substantiations is a different subset of that number.
Okay.
And that is where the decisions about foster care services, those are all made in the investigative and substantiation or unsubstantiation
Several
process.
People around the table are nodding in agreement with that comment. So how do those numbers stack up?
So the number of investigations is a constant number that we've seen over the last a couple of years. So even though there could be differences in the number of reports that come to our attention, what's screened in and what is screened out has remained consistent in the last 2 years, which again is approximately 10,400 investigations.
And Jacqueline, you are partnering, your organization is partnering with the Annie E. Casey Foundation, which we hear about a lot on public radio, the Annie E. Casey Foundation. And that, what has that partnership allowed you to do?
It really has helped us refine our work. We have a philosophy of moving from good to great with their technical support. They're working with us on several work streams, how we collect data. We also have a new dedicated hotline just for reports of child abuse and neglect. We've actually looked at race equity and inclusion issues. We're looking at a practice model, which includes 5 different interventions. And lastly, we're looking at our workforce, stabilizing our workforce.
We're going to talk to everybody at the table about their specific organizations and how they come into to play here and what they do for kids and how some of you do things for the parents as well that are involved in this. But what's the process at DSS when somebody comes to your attention, or how do they come to your attention? Do you find them? Do the police refer them to you? How does it happen?
Generally, the reports come through professional reporters. That could be the school system, the police department. It could be the medical community. It could be an anonymous report. But generally, our reports are coming from professional reporters.
So sometimes there's suspicion, not necessarily a foundation in fact, of people coming to your attention. How do you handle that when it's just a suspicion? We think that this might be a case of abuse.
Right. A suspicion will support a call. You don't have to prove it, or doesn't have to be necessary facts, but if you do have a suspicion, you can, in fact, call the hotline, and there are professional staff mm-hmm. who actually gather information and make a determination whether we would be dispatching a team to conduct an investigation.
How often do those suspicions prove not to be true?
Our substantiation rate is relatively low. We're generally around 15% for the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that 85% of the people who call you with tips on things that might be child abuse turn out not to be?
Not necessarily child abuse, but there could be significant risk that raises concerns with individuals, and people are trying to get some support for a family or a child.
And Mike, while we're talking about reporting, I think it's important to note, and I think everybody around the table would want to echo this, and we'll probably say it several times today, everybody in North Carolina, under North Carolina law, is a mandatory reporter of child abuse and neglect. So if anybody, a private citizen, suspects that there is child abuse or neglect based on information that they have seen or received, they are required to call the hotline and report that to DSS. And there's another piece of that I think it's important for people to know, which is that the statute also has a safe harbor for people who report suspected abuse or neglect. You don't have to be right in order to be protected from any kind of a claim against you for making a report. So if you report in good faith based on the information that you have that you think child abuse or neglect is going on, you can't be attacked by the person that you are reporting.
How do you know it's in good faith? I mean, how do you, if you're, maybe you're a next-door neighbor who doesn't like the people next door, maybe you're an estranged spouse or a relative who doesn't like you, wants to get you into trouble. How is that determined, and are there consequences if it turns out to be that you deliberately falsely reported someone?
Well, ultimately there would be potentially a risk if someone did act intentionally falsely, but the court and the law has a presumption in favor of the reporter being in good faith.
this requirement that we all report, and anybody can jump in on this. Please don't be quiet just because I'm talking to Bob here. Bob's been on the show many times. This requirement, I knew that doctors were required, nurses were required, school teachers, I believe, we all knew that. I didn't know that ordinary people were required. What does that mean, required? If you don't do it, you're breaking the law?
Technically, yes, but it would be something that would be very difficult for anybody to prove that you did have the information and failed to report. The idea is really to inspire and to encourage all North Carolina citizens to act as protectors of all of our children.
So each of the folks around this table have different areas of expertise and different areas of influence in this problem. And I want to start with Pat's Place. Janet Harmon is here. She's the Director of Outreach and Education there. What is Pat's Place?
Pat's Place is the child advocacy center that serves Mecklenburg County. So we have a model that really promotes collaboration among all of those different professionals involved in the investigation and evaluation, primarily of child sexual abuse cases, but of other types of maltreatment or violence that children may have experienced. And we serve to provide a safe, child-friendly environment where the child can receive the support and services they need without having to go from place to place, person to person, talking over and over again about what they may have experienced or what they may have witnessed.
Yeah, I read that yesterday. That's probably something very important. How unique is that? That a child, if a child is in a difficult and sometimes embarrassing situation or an uncomfortable situation about an issue that they're facing or have faced and they don't want to talk about it, to have to explain it to five or six people over and over and over can be traumatic in and of itself. So you bring people together, what, in one setting, and all the experts are there to ask questions one time to get to the bottom of it?
Well, we do provide that one setting, but instead of multiple people sitting in a room with the child asking questions, we have one person who's asking questions. But the investigators are really part of that process and contributing to it, but they don't have to be physically present in the room with the child.
Is that unique?
Well, it's unique in that this is a model that was created by actually a district attorney in Huntsville, Alabama, who saw how child abuse cases were being investigated and realized that sometimes this system that is designed to serve children could cause harm in and of itself. And so really wanted to look at how do we promote collaboration and how do we make a more child-friendly system.
You specifically mentioned that you deal a lot with sexual abuse, child sexual abuse, but the same thing could hold true, the same approach would hold true for any kind of child abuse. That could be very frightening for a child to talk about it.
Absolutely. And what we know is that very often children don't tell, or they may tell a little bit.
Or they're told not to tell, or they'll get in even more trouble.
Or they may just fear what the consequences might be if they do tell. So when there is an opportunity for children to have to talk about what they may have experienced, we want to give them as much as possible the safety to be able to do that.
I don't mean this to be a silly or flippant question, but who is Pat?
Actually, it's an excellent question. Pat Wolf was a child advocate in Charlotte who was involved in the process of kind of bringing together a child advocacy center, actually spearheaded by what was then Council for Children. She unfortunately died before she was able to see the realization of the child advocacy center. So when it came time to choose a name, someone suggested, what about Pat's Place? Not only a way to honor Pat, but it sounds much less intimidating for a child to think about going to Pat's Place than to think about going to, you know, the Child Abuse Assessment Center.
Sharon Hirsch is here. She's the president and CEO of Prevent Child Abuse North Carolina. When we come back, I want to talk about that issue and what you are beyond your name, because it's pretty much spelled out in your name what you do, but we're going to find out how you do that and the role eventually as we go through this program, the role that everybody can play, should play, that you are advocating that they do play in reporting and also preventing and helping parents not abuse their children, because you can sometimes diffuse a situation being a stranger even. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about child abuse and neglect, the incidence of it in Charlotte-Mecklenburg, what can be done about it, which these folks around the table are encouraging you to do, and we'll get to that in a few minutes here. Jacqueline McKnight is here. She's the Deputy Director of Child and Family Services at the Mecklenburg Department of Social Services. Janet Harmon is Director of Outreach and Education at Pat's Place. Sharon Hirsch, whom we have yet to hear from, but we're about to, is President and CEO of Prevent Child Abuse NC. And Bob Simmons is the Executive Director of the Council for Children's Rights and the chair of the Mecklenburg Child Fatality Prevention and Protection Team. So aside from the obvious in your organization's title, Sharon, what does Prevent Child Abuse NC do? Because there are lots of different organizations involved in this.
Well, we're the only statewide organization that focuses on preventing abuse and neglect from happening in the first place. And we do that by both raising awareness around the issue of prevention, not necessarily just the issue of abuse and neglect. And then we work to build capacity at the local level for agencies and for parents to support and strengthen families. So we support evidence-based parenting programs that are built on evidence that we know when they're in place and can help families, children are safer. We also foster conversations at the local level. We've been screening the documentary film Resilience to raise awareness about the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study and the things that we can do to prevent abuse and neglect from happening. And then we try to help communities develop actual plans to prevent abuse and neglect. One of the things that's really striking about our state is that we don't have a state plan to prevent child abuse and neglect, and local communities, for the most part, don't have plans in place to prevent abuse. And I believe that when we fail to plan, we plan to fail our kids. And it's really important that we do that.
How do you prevent something that hasn't occurred yet? How do you know that it might occur? Are there characteristics that you can identify in people or communities?
Absolutely. We know that there are lots of risk factors that include families that are under a lot of stress, families that have experienced abuse and neglect among parents when they were growing up. There are a wide range of risk factors. We also know that there are protective factors that we can be looking for to support and strengthen families. So things like making sure families have access to basic services, access to health care, a safe, stable place to live, access to food on their tables. Those are the kind of economic stresses that can place a family at risk. Also, families that are isolated. People who don't have a strong support network often really struggle. And then parents that don't know much about child development or have had experience with good parenting skills are also at risk.
So how do these people come to your attention?
Well, they actually don't come to our attention. They come to the attention of the Department of Social Services or agencies like Pat's Place across the state. Thompson Children's Center here in Charlotte is another agency where they may come to the attention of, and they actually provide the direct services. We actually work to support and strengthen the professionals that work in those agencies.
But if people come to Pat's Place, they've already been abused, correct?
Well, in order to come to Pat's Place, there needs to be an active investigation, either with the Department of Social Services or one of the law enforcement entities. So there's an investigation. They haven't determined whether or not the abuses occurred, but there is that suspicion.
And there are also a lot of other community-based organizations that provide those parenting programs. So some examples of those programs would be Triple P is the positive parenting program. It's available through public health departments across the state and in a number of private agencies. Programs like Incredible Years or the Strengthening Families program, Nurse Family Partnership. These are all evidence-based programs that have been proven to prevent abuse and neglect, and there are a variety of community agencies. One of our biggest challenges is for many families, there's a stigma associated with going to a parenting program, and we really need to change
Why?
That social norm. Well, we live in a culture where we think that parenting's just going to come naturally, and folks feel very judged about their parenting. We need to change that norm and say it's okay to ask for help.
Well, you see that a lot on TV when a new parent when a baby is born, and one of the parents says, "I don't think I can do this," and the mother or the grandmother says, "It comes naturally. You'll be okay." It doesn't necessarily.
and I'm a firm believer that if we keep doing the same things we've always done, we're not going to get better at this.
You just threw out a litany of names of organizations that help people, and we got four organizations here, one of which DSS, everybody knows. Pat's Place, maybe not so much. The other two, not so much, perhaps. But how do people know about these? How do you find out about these places? I mean, that help parents learn how to be a parent. These are people who haven't done anything wrong, so they're not in the system, so to speak. How do they find out about all these helpful organizations?
So they can actually contact the Department of social services.
But why would they? How would they know to do that?
Well, that's...
sitting here thinking, I wouldn't know to do that.
And that's a good point. I think there needs to be much more advertisement and positive advertisement about the fact that there is truly family support that is out there. We are in a process of actually preparing a proposal where we would actually have not just a hotline for reports of abuse and neglect, but a hotline where parents who might feel stressed, a victim of domestic violence, who may feel that she's at risk as well as her children, where they can actually contact and actually get support on the line.
I also want to give out that number that you, and we'll put this on our website as well, but that number, that's a new hotline number to call to report child abuse. It's 980-31-HELPS. That's all you have to know. 980-31-HELPS. And we'll put that on our website. It was launched late last year.
That's correct.
And it's up and running now.
Mm-hmm. Mike, just going back to what you asked about how people would know what they can get in touch with, one of the things that's happening in Mecklenburg County right now is that a lot of the types of programs that Sharon was describing are in place in different parts of Mecklenburg County, different organizations, but none of it is really coordinated. Mm. For example, Nurse Family Partnerships exist in Mecklenburg County primarily through the work of Care Ring, which is in the Children and Family Services Center with our agency. But one of the things that Child Fatality Prevention and Protection Team is doing under Jacqueline's leadership, actually, is to put together a more coordinated vision for child abuse prevention in Mecklenburg County, which is bringing together these different groups. And we're going to be working with Prevent Child Abuse North Carolina, with Pat's Place, to try to pull everybody together to coordinate these things in a way that doesn't leave them in silos that are unidentifiable to the people in the community, so that parents can find the help they need.
It sounds mind-boggling, is it?
It is a very difficult practice. Mm-hmm. I'm celebrating 31 years working in the field of child welfare. I believe that it is an area where you have to have the right heart to do this work, but it is so rewarding. There is a lot of strength out there. I think a lot of times you think of the deficits that families come to the table with. They actually come to the table with a lot of strengths. It's our responsibility to build on that.
There's been talk around this table this morning about people who have all these economic stresses on them and other stresses that lead to child abuse and neglect sometimes. Is that always the case? This is not the province of poor people. This, like spouse abuse, crosses all socioeconomic boundaries, correct?
Absolutely
right.
So even wealthy people have these challenges?
Of course they do. First of all, parenting is really hard. But we also know from the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, which was done about 20 years ago, it was a study of 17,000 people by Kaiser Permanente and the Centers for Disease Control. And they looked at folks' health records as adults and compared them to 10 questions about childhood adversity that included child abuse and neglect and child sexual abuse, but also things like domestic violence, loss of a parent, or substance abuse in the home, and they found that adverse experiences are really common. Many people have experienced one or more. One in five have experienced child sexual abuse. One in four have experienced child abuse or neglect. It's much more prevalent in our society than we realize, mm-hmm. and it's okay to talk about it and to ask for help, and that's really the first step in the process.
One of your organizations provided a whole list of things, a whole list of factors that can lead to problems later in life if you experience them mm-hmm. as a child, and I read through them, and I thought, I must have been a very sheltered, lucky person. Because not mm-hmm. one of those things is in my background. It's amazing.
You are very lucky.
Yes, I'm very lucky.
Very rare.
Very,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
very rare. Because we know those things do affect your behavior and mm-hmm. your health for a lifetime. You're more likely to have heart disease, lung cancer, depression if you're experiencing these things early. And that's why we focus so hard on preventing it from ever happening
in the
first place.
We'll talk about that later, but we'll talk about it now because there's something called the Adverse Childhood Experiences, or ACE study, A-C-E. It's one of the largest investigations of its kind of the link between mistreatment in childhood and a person's well-being later in life. So you've already gone through some of these experiences in childhood. Let's talk about some. Well, let's talk about those in more specific. What kinds of things are we talking about? Is it just being because my father did discipline us with things that would be considered child abuse today, but they weren't then, and we as children didn't consider it abusive. They just would smack us once in a while. What kinds of things are you talking about?
We're talking about things that happen on a repeated basis that cause toxic stress. We're not talking about things that happened once or twice, but things that create a flight or fight kind of response in children. We know that when this happens over and over again, that it not only affects kids' developing brains, but it also affects their immune systems.
And this obviously can include what being yelled at a lot?
Yes.
Being belittled?
Absolutely.
It doesn't have to be physical.
It can be emotional abuse.
Wow.
And it can be exposure to domestic violence. It can be exposure to a parent who has a substance abuse issue.
So which of these factors come into play that make things worse later in life? Is it the duration of these abusive incidents? Is it the frequency of these incidences? Is it the
it's a combination.
Severity? Is it the age at which you experience these things? What's the factor here?
It's all of those things. And it's most severe when it happens earliest in life, because we know now, based on the brain science, that babies' brains are growing really fast. And the more adversity a baby experiences, the more it harms that development. So the earlier we can get involved with families, that's why programs like Nurse Family Partnership are so important, because we're investing in moms and babies even prenatally and helping folks understand child development and the things that a mom can do to be healthy and to have a good relationship with their child.
And I would think that child sexual abuse is the factors there, and the effects there are far worse, or not, or I don't want to put words in your mouth. How would you compare those factors, those mistreatment factors, to just being abused verbally or being abused physically or punished too often or not fed or not never spoken to or never read to?
Well, I think part of it is that each individual child may experience that differently, and it may be because they may or may not have supportive adults in their life. You know, there are so many factors that go into it. So what may be traumatic for one child may not be as significant for another child. So you really have to look at sort of that totality. But it can be extremely damaging, particularly when you're talking about that betrayal of trust and the shame that may be involved.
So, Bob, let's go back to this ACE study, this adverse childhood experiences. They have lasting effects, and Sharon mentioned a few minutes ago some of them, which includes severe obesity and diabetes, depression, suicide, greater incidence of STDs, heart disease, cancer, stroke, greater incidences of alcoholism and drug abuse, and shorter life expectancy by 20 years. In some cases. How do you know? How do you measure these things? How do you connect the dots to abuse?
Well, there is a lot of data, actually, that has been accumulated across the country in determining how ACE scores, and as Sharon mentioned, it was 20 years ago when Kaiser Permanente did the study the first time, to connect the different types of stress, toxic stress, as Sharon described, on these not just mental but physical consequences and outcomes for people in the future. And one of the things we see at Council for Children's Rights, because we are working primarily with children who are really most exposed to a large number of ACEs over an extended period of time, it manifests in behavior. It manifests in their involvement in the juvenile justice system, in their involvement in mental health commitments where we do the work with the children, sometimes in the special education needs that children have. So often what we are doing at Council for Children's Rights is dealing with the children who have experienced the most ACEs as they are actually going through in real time another ACE, which, for example, being arrested and being in juvenile court or being committed to a mental health facility, those are very traumatic for children and for their families. So that's really the point at which we get involved with the effects of these in the community. And it really has a very adverse effect on the ongoing likelihood that these children will succeed as members of our community. It really connects into the Opportunity Task Force report in the category of child and family stability. If we can't create greater stability for more of our children and families in our community, we're going to continue to see these adverse health consequences. So it really becomes a public health issue more than an issue related to one specific subspecialty of that.
And how long have we known and understood these connections?
I would say we really started talking about the connection of trauma and the implications probably since about 2005. It really became...
So it's pretty recent.
I would say so.
Wow. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Mm-hmm. Just that's shocking that it's so recent because we have so many societal problems in communities all over the country that you could... I don't want to connect those dots, but can you connect those dots to some of those problems?
Yes, I definitely think we can. But we have to look at the positive side of it as well. I don't want everybody to be listening to us today and to think that there's nothing that we can do about this, because on the opposite side, and I think Sharon mentioned this as well, and I think that Janet has also, we don't just have risk factors. We have protective factors as well. So even a child who has suffered a large number of ACEs as a child, if they also have adults in their life who are willing and able to provide them stability, support, encouragement, those can build that resilience even in the face of the negative consequences of ACEs.
I want to be clear about what we're talking about, because every time we have a discussion like this, this question comes up, and it's come up again from Bucky on Facebook, who says, what is the limit on disciplining children currently? I was spanked as a child. Is that now child abuse? So what are we talking about? What constitutes abuse? We know the heinous stuff. What could be interpreted as abuse?
Generally, when you're talking about physical abuse, you're talking about excessive.
What's excessive? Isn't that in the eye of the beholder? If you smack your children in the grocery store in front of other people, you can be arrested, can't you?
There could be a report made. As far as the criminal aspect of that, I'll leave that to the law enforcement. But there could be a report made. It could be investigated. Generally, it really depends on how it is defined as severe. It's not just usually physical discipline. It is anything that could be much more excessive. Burns, bruises, broken bones, those are the things that actually kind of come to our attention for physical
abuse. Those are the things that, as you just said, yeah, that's easy to spot. That's what you should be, some of those things are what you should be looking for if you're concerned about child abuse. We'll talk more about that when we come back. We have to take a break at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about child abuse. We're going to get to how to prevent it and how you can be involved in preventing it, because everybody should be on the line for this, according to the folks working professionally to do this. Jacqueline McKnight is here. She's Deputy Director of Child and Family Services for Mecklenburg County's DSS. Janet Harmon is Director of Outreach and Education at Pat's Place, and there's an education component about this that I want to talk about. Sharon Hirsch is with, she's President and CEO of Prevent Child Abuse NC, and Bob Simmons is Executive Director for the Council for Children's Rights. And on your website, Sharon, there is, a quiz or a, how would you describe it?
It's actually an online course that's available for free. It's a two-hour course, and then you take a quiz at the end of it, and if you pass with an 80% rating, you'll get a certificate, but it helps folks recognize and respond appropriately to child maltreatment.
It shows you what to look for. It teaches you what to look for and how to respond to it. Is that what you're telling me?
That's right. It teaches you the signs of abuse and neglect that make you suspicious, and then teaches you how to make a report, whether it's to your local Department of Social Services, to the Division of Child Development and Early Education if you're suspecting abuse in a child care setting, or to call 911 if a child's at imminent risk.
I don't want to point that out because, Bob, you mentioned that in the break. If a child's at imminent risk of physical harm, you call 911. You don't call the helpline I gave out a little while ago. But the helpline is there, 980-31-HELPS. So Do you have any idea how many people have taken that course?
Do.
Okay.
We had almost 30,000 people take it last year in North Carolina, which was wonderful. And that was particularly because the Division of Child Development and Early Education has made it mandatory for all child care professionals in licensed settings in North Carolina to take it as part of their orientation and onboarding. Last year was the first year that they had that requirement, so we saw a large spike. And we really want coaches. We want church youth group leaders, anyone who works with children to particularly take that course. It's not mandatory in our public schools. It would be wonderful if the Charlotte-Mecklenburg school systems and other school systems made it mandatory for all teachers and school counselors to take that course.
Well, that brings me to Bill's email. Bill and Davidson, teachers and schools in general are not equipped to deal with serious abuse, he writes. As the student-counselor ratio has shrunk, much abuse goes unreported. 20 years ago, we had a social worker, a psychologist, and roughly one counselor for 450 students. Today, the social worker and psychologist have disappeared, and the counselor's loads have grown. We talked about this on an earlier program. How has that impacted this? Is that why, perhaps, around the country, the incidence of child abuse reports have gone up 38% in the last 10 years? Could that be why?
Well, Mike, I think that that is an element in Mecklenburg County. I can't really speak to what's going on in the rest of the country. But one of the things that Child Fatality Prevention and Protection Team has done is to work with CMS, which is part of our group, to expand the number of counselors, psychologists, social workers who are in the school system. And the Board of County Commissioners has given some money in particular to increase the number of counselors, but we're still way behind where we need to be. And one of the points I think that's relevant to the comment that came in from the listener is that order in classrooms has become a very important thing in our community. And children who are affected by abuse and neglect will often manifest that through a freeze response, which is not fight or flight. So it doesn't show up in behavior. They will be quiet. They will sit quietly. They will fail, and they will disappear because what they're trying to do is to hide in plain sight. And that's one of the things that makes it hard for teachers in particular to be to identify child abuse and neglect because these children are sitting quietly but not succeeding.
Let's flip the coin. Just as there are negative effects to abuse and neglect over the years that they go into adulthood and lead to a 20-year shortened lifespan in some cases, there are positives to good parenting and being treated well as a child in that situation. Prevent Child Abuse NC talks in their literature about the importance of positive early childhood experiences, being nurtured, having a positive relationship with a caring adult. And that's just one of what you cite as five positive factors. What are the other four?
It's part of the protective factors framework. It's really important to know that there are five factors, but only one of them is actually about children. The other four are about strengthening the adults that are around kids. So the one that's about children, and I use my hand signals, and I know I'm on the radio, but it helps me.
Go ahead.
The one about children is the thumbs-up sign, and that reminds us that children who have strong social and emotional competence, who...
So it looks like the like thing on Facebook.
That's right. Okay, all right. That know how to interact with their peers and who can talk to other adults are going to be stronger and safer kids. We also know that parents who have knowledge of parenting skills and understand child development, understand the importance of the serve-response interaction, who understand the developmental differences between what a 2-year-old can do and what a 4-year-old can do and what an 8-year-old can do, their children are going to be safer. Your middle finger represents social connections, and you don't want that one to stand up by itself. And that's how you remember that, is that we all need our tribe. We all need our connections and our friends. Mm-hmm. Having a strong support network always means kids are going to be safer because parents are going to have other folks to rely on when things get tough. Parental resilience is another one, and that's represented by your ring finger. And that's how parents who are experiencing a lot of stress or a crisis are able to bounce back and not fall apart and can learn from it and do differently the next time. And then your pinky finger might be your smallest one, but I think concrete supports for families sometimes are the most important protective factor, and that's access to health care. It's a living wage job. It's paid family leave. It's food on your table. It sometimes is even just access to diapers, making sure that you can meet the basic needs of your family. When you have all five of those things in place, families are strong and kids are safe. And it's not rocket science. And those are all things that all of us can help families accomplish.
There are people in the world who believe that there's evil in the world and that there are evil people in the world. When you look at abusers, parents who abuse their children, or aunts and uncles who are grandmothers and grandfathers who abuse their family members, are these bad people necessarily, or are they people who didn't have good role models themselves, who were abused themselves, who are operating under intense stress for one reason or another, economic or not? When somebody abuses a child and you conduct an interview with them at Pat's Place, how would you characterize the abuser when they are confronted with their behavior? Do they sometimes have an epiphany?
Well, I think sexual abuse is a little bit different than looking at parents who, in their effort to teach or to discipline, maybe cross the line, or they're misinformed, or they have inappropriate expectations, or they're dealing with a great deal of stress. While most children who are sexually abused are abused by somebody they know and trust, it's not necessarily a parent or a caregiver. About 30% are family members, but others are trusted adults in the community. So I do think the dynamics are a little bit different from a parent who may be physically disciplines because they don't know other ways or are dealing with some other
stressors.
Well, Jacqueline,
you've been doing this for 30-some years in both New York City and here, so how would you describe those parents, and how do you describe most of their reactions when they are confronted with the fact that they have been abusive?
I do believe that we're seeing more and more individuals who actually have been exposed to some victimization themselves. We're seeing intergenerational patterns of abuse and neglect. So when that deprivation has been a part of their makeup, you do see it, unfortunately, in their parenting of their children. So I say that they're not horrible people. They're people who need support and need some development around their ability to parent effectively.
Can that behavior be changed? Can it be reversed? Can you learn?
Absolutely. And it is not every person who is going to be able to be effective, but we have seen more and more families with the right interventions who have been able to benefit. And I just want to acknowledge, although that I have done 30 years, I just want to acknowledge my team. I have a team of over 400 individuals who go out and do this work every day, and they are absolutely awesome.
Okay. Aaron on Facebook, what does the data say about the effectiveness of corporal punishment in behavior modification in children and their relationship with parents?
I'm not sure that I have data on that, although I believe that the approach that most of us take is generally that if you hit a child, what you teach a child is to hit people, and that we should think very seriously before we use any kind of corporal punishment, and the type, the nature, the extent, the circumstances, the way it is applied, so that you're teaching, if possible, a positive lesson about discipline and behavior rather than a negative lesson about human interaction. Mm-hmm. And I kind of want to go back to what Jacqueline was talking about. And the question of whether there is evil in the world. I'm not sure I want to get into that question, but I do want to get into something which is important in the kind of trauma-informed care that we want to bring to the entire community. And that is, instead of asking the question of a child who is misbehaving or a parent who may have abused a child, what is wrong with you? Ask what happened to you. Learn their own personal story, because it may involve abuse of them as a child, mm-hmm. and they're passing on that lesson, which is learned by hitting, to their own children. And we really need to try and stop that by, instead of casting blame, looking for the underlying causes and trying to achieve healing and wellness instead of punishment.
And Rebecca on Facebook says, you can't ignore the economic impact. Most folks outside the panel demographic are in very dire straits, indicating that you all are rich, but you're not. That kind of stress can cause even the most loving parents to lose it. Talk about the economic stresses, because a lot of people are hand-to-mouth out there today because of the lack of a middle class, the decline of the middle class, let's put it that way. What about, is that impacting this? Are people turning their tensions, their frustrations out on their children?
I think we have seen patterns when the economy is much more challenged. You do see an increase in reports, particularly when there is a loss of a job. You do see a lot of stress, and I think my colleague actually spoke to this really well with regard to just basic needs not being met. I do want to raise it from the perspective, and I think to be totally transparent, that generally the individuals that do come to the Department of Social Services attention through a report are families that are actually much more challenged financially. These are not generally our wealthier individuals within our community. They do have resources that many of our families do not have. I also want to acknowledge the fact that many of the families that come to our attention are families of color. Who are really struggling financially and from very specific communities where there's lack of resources and supports.
And where there's danger in the community, and that can be a stress on a child as well. And in a way, it's child abuse.
It's trauma. It's community violence can, in fact, create a trauma as well.
You see daddy and other male figures being arrested on a regular basis, that's traumatic.
That's an adverse implication, yes.
You're smiling knowingly.
Knowingly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Council for Children's Rights provides legal services and advocacy for children in cases involving special education and child welfare and high conflict custody cases and mental health and juvenile delinquency. How many of the cases that your organization handles deal directly with abuse and neglect situations as opposed to something worse?
Actually, very few of our cases arise directly from abuse or neglect because that's not primarily what our mandate is and what our work is, although we do review all child-serving systems in the community, and we do, as the report that we'll be releasing today on maltreatment, we keep track of all of those different systems because in many ways we are a part of what we would think of as the entire child-serving system, but we are also apart from it. Because part of our role is to be the accountability measure to an extent, quality control. When the system is not performing the way it ought to, when an institution is not providing the services it should provide, we step in and try and be sure that that child's rights are recognized. And we do research and policy work that helps drive forward practice and policy changes in the community. And in fact, we work very closely with all of the groups at the table, including Prevent Child Abuse North Carolina, but the Department of Social Services in particular, going back to what Jacqueline was just talking about, is part of Race Matters for Juvenile Justice, which is the group here in town, which is trying to reduce disproportionality and disparity in the juvenile justice system, which includes Department of Social Services, CMS, the police department, the courts.
You, Bob, and you, Sharon, are both wearing pins with pinwheels on them. I want to talk about this very briefly because in April, a lot of people will remember going around town, driving around town, and seeing these pinwheels in people's yards. And I've always wondered, well, that's nice. Did they buy those at Black Hawk? Why are they there? But these are reminders about it's a symbol. It's a national symbol for Prevent Child Abuse in America Month, and it started in 2008. So they're called Pinwheels for Prevention. Do you think they're effective? I only have a minute left, and how do they help?
I do. I think they're a conversation starter.
Okay,
which is a really really important piece. The pinwheel is a symbol of great childhoods, and that's what we want for all children. And what it does is start that conversation about what anybody can do to prevent abuse and neglect. And the most important thing that I want folks to leave with at the end of this conversation is that the presence of a safe, nurturing relationship with an adult is a game changer for a lot of children. So get involved and do something to help a family.
And everybody plays a role. If you know the person next door is having a tough time, if you see somebody having trouble with their kids, compliment them on how they're handling their kids so that they feel reinforced and positively so. Sharon Hirsch from Prevent Child Abuse NC, Janet Harmon for Pat's Place, Jacqueline McKnight from DSS, Bob Simmons from the Council for Children's Rights. Thank you all for the hour.